And on today's Windy City Queercast, Alexandra Billings and I are exploring my sexual occupation options. That's right, from hooker to madam to porn producer. You think I'm kidding. Plus, we have the review of Burn After Reading from Richard Knight Jr. and Levi Kreis on the show, starring as Jerry Lee Lewis in Million Dollar Quartet. It's a big, fat, full show with Miss Billings all the way from Los Angeles.
Windy City Queercast.
Gays and lesbians are all the rage.
We're here and we're queer.
Windy City Queercast.
Windy City Queercast.
Windy City Queercast.
Windy City Queercast.
We're talking mega gay.
Ooh, I like that.
I'm Alexander Benz.
I'm Amy Matheny.
This Queercast is brought to you in part by
Bud Light. Bud Light keeps it coming.
American Airlines, offering the GLBT community exciting vacation packages online at aa.com/rainbow.
And by Broadway in Chicago. For the hottest tickets in town, visit broadwayinchicago.com.
Someone to talk to in such a long time, and it's strange all we have in common, and your company was just the thing I needed tonight. But somehow I feel I should apologize, 'cause I'm just a little shaken, but what's going on inside?
And you're listening to the Windy City Queercast, show number 245. I'm Amy Matheny.
I'm not.
You're not.
I didn't even say my name.
Alexander Billings.
I'm Chuck Woolery.
You're Chuck Woolery?
Does anybody even know what I'm talking about when
no.
I say Chuck Woolery?
Did you hear my interview with Lily Tomlin last week?
No, but
genius.
I knew you were...
40
doing
minutes
that.
Long. It's a really nice one. You should listen. All her early
How is she? What's she like? Tell me.
Well, if you listen to the interview, you'll hear. She is lovely. She's exactly what you think. She's amazing. And it was supposed to be a 20-minute interview, and we talked for 40 minutes, and she out-talked me, which rarely happens.
Really?
Yeah. She even said, she goes, I'm not letting you get a word in edgewise here, am I? I just laughed. I said, you don't know how odd that is. So just, I'm enjoying it. Keep talking. And she just went off. So
oh,
you have to
fantastic.
Listen. That's, I guess, a little back plug for anybody, not a butt plug, but a back plug for anybody who missed listening to that show. Go and download show 243. That's the Lily Tomlin show.
Here's my favorite Lily Tomlin joke.
Okay.
Hello, Mr. Sinatra. Yes, this is Miss Tomlin from the telephone company. We see here that we have a bill of $53.22, and we were just wondering what you were going to do about it. It's good, right?
It's very good, Ernestine. I like it.
Thank you.
Yeah, she talks about Ernestine and Edith Ann and how she created
them. Does she?
Oh, yeah. I love Lily Tomlin. My brother and I used to listen to Lily Tomlin albums. Remember when people listened to comic albums?
Listen, I still have them. I have the original Coco album with Katharine Hepburn.
Oh.
It's Coco! Coco! Yeah.
Well, you should come here. You know, she's coming to Chicago November 1st, so...
Katharine Hepburn?
No.
She's dead.
She's long gone. Until you resurrect her.
Oh, Lily Tomlin is coming. I thought you were talking about Kelly.
Lily Tomlin. I know. And I need somebody to go with because Kelly can't go. So you could be my date.
That would be fantastic if my agent would let me out of town. But every time I leave, he yells at me.
Oh, dear. Would you like me to call your agent and yell at him or her?
Would you? That would be fantastic. Him. He's fantastic.
Him. What are you doing? Are you filming something? Are you making money out there?
I am making money, but I was filming a movie and then it got postponed to February. So now I'm filming nothing.
You're filming nothing?
Nothing.
What's
no,
the storyline of that?
It's nothing. I'm riding on Candace Kane's coattails. Oh, I made alliteration again. Candace Kane's coattails.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's what I'm doing. Every party she goes to, I just follow behind her and sweep up her poo.
Aw. That's not true.
It is true, but it's fine. I don't mind it. You know, I don't care. As long as I don't care which part of the bus I'm in, as long as I'm on the bus, I don't give a shit. Yeah. I'm not proud.
Yeah.
I'm fine with it.
You are hilarious.
I don't care.
We miss you. Are you coming back to Chicago anytime soon to do some singing, dancing, jokes, any of that kind of yuck, yuck fun stuff that you do?
I refuse. I won't go. You can't make me. No, I was going to go, and then something happened. Oh, I was supposed to, the whole thing with the trip and the pfft and the pee. I was supposed to do that, and then that didn't happen. And then I had to cancel the trip. But I think I may be out there in December.
Oh, good. Yeah.
Maybe.
You and I should talk about that if you're here in December.
Yeah, that would be good.
Stuff
I love staying.
I'm getting new furniture. Little
piece again?
Here and there. Yeah, little piece here and there.
Jesus Christ.
I know.
You're a redecorating hooker.
I know. If I was a hooker, I'd be redecorating a lot faster than I am.
If you were a hooker, you'd be decorating. What?
I'd be making more money.
Why would you?
I'd be making more money. I think I would be a hot hooker, don't you think?
You would be a fantastic hooker, Amy, because you have the gift of gab. You're highly intelligent. You're hot. And men would love you. And women would love you.
Yeah,
but, you know, women don't, because, you know, I'm an ex-hooker. And women don't always – I'm sitting here on the back porch, and all my neighbors can hear me, by the way. I'm an ex-hooker. Hello? Would you like to borrow that sugar now? But women don't buy sex. They don't do it. Because, you know, Heidi Fleiss was in the midst of creating this big brothel for women only. And she couldn't get any funding because women just don't want to do it. There's a whole stigma against, you know, you're not supposed to be sexual.
Couples would buy hookers, right?
Oh, yeah. All the time. All the time.
Yeah. I think I'd be a really good hooker because I'm a good salesperson. I can talk about anything.
Yep.
Right?
It's true. Yeah. Oh, absolutely. It's true.
I can walk for hours in heels if that's what it takes, too.
Yeah, well, then you'd be a streetwalker, which I've been too, which is a job you don't want. It's not the hours are bad and the lunch breaks. Ugh. But if you get a good clientele, 90% of your job is talking. Truly. Mm-hmm. 90% of your job is talking.
Boy.
That is my job.
It's too bad when I was in elementary school and junior high and you're taking those vocational tests as to what you'd be good at doing. If they would have just told me you'd be like a queer talk show host or a hooker, I would have just really would have just cleared out the two path choices for me really quickly. I don't know that I'd be talking to you on this podcast right now. Seriously.
That's really good.
Because I've always had those. I've always had those late night fantasies that I would be a stripper. I just want to be a stripper at some point. I don't know if
you don't want to be a stripper. I was an ex-stripper as well. By the way, I was an ex-stripper. Now I'm all my
Can I have some milk?
Yes.
To go with the sugar?
That cream. Yes, there you go.
Oh,
bake your cake.
Dear. Were you in
you
one of those?
You don't want to be a
No.
No. Bad. It's not a good, for all the strippers out there, get out while you can. It's not a fun job. Every place smells like a big cum bucket. It's bad.
Ooh.
It's just not fun.
Ooh.
No, it's bad.
Okay.
Just saying.
So, okay, you've just destroyed my thoughts on being like Demi Moore in Striptease, which is just a guilty pleasure. I have to watch it every time it's on.
Fantastic.
But I could have been a good showgirl then, maybe. Like,
yes. It would have been a great showgirl.
But they don't make enough money to really do it.
I made buckets of money.
Being a showgirl?
Buckets of money.
Huh.
Tubs of it.
Yeah.
I was rich, honey.
So
I had a lot.
So what kind of showgirl were you?
I worked at the Baton. I worked at Club Victoria. These are all in Chicago, Illinois.
Right.
These are all female impersonation bars. And I did that for not a long time, probably about 5 years, actually. It wasn't really that long.
Well, maybe
that was a big...
Maybe I could be a madam. That's actually what I'd be really good because I produce well. So I'm not going to be a hooker.
Yes.
And I'm definitely not going to be a streetwalker because that's just too hard. And I'm not going to be a stripper, even though I would kind of like to see men just give me dollars and thinking they can have it and they can't.
You
I don't know why.
You don't want to work in a bucket of dried out old cum, so forget that.
No, I don't.
Next.
And then if I'm not really going to be a madam.
Yeah.
I don't know. Maybe I should just shoot porno films.
Oh, that's a good idea. That's very
lucrative. I could make a lot of money doing that, too.
Yeah, you could make a lot of money doing that.
I mean, I don't want to be in them. I would be in them sometimes, but I think it'd be better to just, like, shoot some really hot lesbian and occasionally a man porno movie.
Lesbian porn does not sell, dear.
I know, because it sucks.
It doesn't suck. It's just, again, we're back to the old, like, women aren't supposed to be sexual people. And that's just kind of the way it is. You know, it's crazy. It's just a double standard. And let me tell you something. Having almost married a porn star in the 80s, being on a porn set is really dull and full of a lot of drugs and misogynistic, egocentric, methed out people. It's not pleasant. Like, it's kind of like filming an indie movie with mongoloids.
Oh, dear.
It's not fun.
All right.
It's
well, then
good.
I just need to become a nun. None of those things are going to work for me. I'm going to move to
Vatican
City.
That's the only profession so far you've named that I haven't done.
That's true.
And really, who wants to be a nun? I mean, the name says it.
Yeah.
Nun.
Nun. Spelled the same way forwards and backwards, though.
Oh, so is mom.
So is mom. I've never done that either.
No, I haven't either. I don't want to do that. I don't want to be a mother.
No.
No,
hey,
that's too much.
You were speaking of the crystal meth at the porn shows. And,
yes.
And I know that you're somebody now who's clean and sober.
Yes.
Did you see Miss Tatum O'Neill on Okra?
I didn't see her, but I heard what was going on. What happened to her? Tell me.
Well, you know, she was on. It's the first time she's talked about being stopped for trying to purchase cocaine. Was it cocaine or heroin? I can't remember.
I think it was cocaine.
You know, it was like right before she was going to be a year sober, and she was arrested and trying to buy it. And so Oprah tried to have her on and tried to talk to her about why did you do that, to which she started to try to answer it. And then she went, I don't know. You know, this is why this is baffling. I've been to all the rehab centers you can go to. I've been to Hazelden. I've been to the Canyon, whatever it is. I mean, she's been to all the very expensive recovery programs, and she was going to a meeting a day, and, you know, she was working her program, and, you know, Oprah really wanted to know why. And I'm just so baffled by Oprah time and time again by how much she doesn't know. You know what I mean? It's like when she has lesbians on and she says, I don't know. She just says shit like, well, I don't know how you could have ever been with a man and then come out as a lesbian. And you just want to go, really, Oprah? Really? Really?
Don't you?
And this is what she wanted to know, like, well, did you go out and what was the final straw? And you know, I mean, Tatum was like, I woke up. You know, that was the final straw.
That's
like,
right.
It was a day
Tuesday.
Like any fucking other day, you know?
That's right.
Except
right.
That day, it sounded like a really good idea to go buy cocaine. You know,
right.
Thank God the universe, like, intervened. But she kept trying to ask her these very specific questions, and then Tatum didn't know how to answer them. And then Oprah kind of seemed upset. Like, well, why would you agree to an interview when you can't answer these things? And I wanted to go, duh, Oprah, it's called, like, alcoholism and addiction. Yeah. And if it was logical, people wouldn't go to a meeting every damn day, or people wouldn't, you know, this wouldn't be a huge national issue and it wouldn't be considered a disease. That'd be like going, what was the final straw that had cancer, you know, attack your liver, you know,
that's right.
Or have cancer attack your breast? I don't know. I woke up and I found the lump, but that's not when it happened.
Yeah.
You know, it was so funny and
well,
odd.
Well, it's weird. I think people want explanations. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
When they don't understand something, they have to know why. I mean, I'm sort of the same way. I don't understand something and I want to go, well, why? But why? But why? But why? And I think that's probably the reason and I also think that people feel like strangely betrayed in a way, you know, especially when you're a public figure and you go, everything's great. It's like Liza, you know, Liza is like, everything's great. And then, you know, that she keels over from a brain hemorrhage from drinking too much, you know, gasoline out of her car or whatever she was doing. And I think people feel betrayed. And so they're just like, well, if we could just pinpoint, you know, like you said, pinpoint the time, maybe we could figure out how to solve this problem.
Well, yeah, Oprah said, you must have some demons that started very young in your childhood. Have you discovered what those demons are? And Tatum, like, looked at her like, it was hilarious. Like, you could just see Tatum's face going, this woman really has no clue what's going on with me. Like, the fact that it would be like, yes, I could have been beaten or raped or anything, but that doesn't make somebody such an addict that they can't get out of the cycle of addiction. You know,
well, here's what she should have done is O'Neill should have turned to Oprah and said, you know, I'll bet if you equate my need to shove stuff up my nose with your need to shove ding dongs in your mouth, you
would
probably.
Well, and Oprah did that. I mean, Oprah did kind of, you know, because it all has to come back to Oprah. So, and I love Oprah. So I'm just really.
I do too.
Jibbing at the, you know, somebody who does the exact same thing I do, which is, you know, no matter who I'm interviewing, it relates back to me because I'm the host. But
that's right.
But, you know, Oprah did say, I understand, you know, it's the same as food. But I think Oprah only equates her food stuff with, you know, the fact that she was molested as a kid or I don't know. I don't know what she, I'm not her. So I don't know what she does, but she obviously has pinpointed some sort of great demon that is associated with her food. Whereas I think people who struggle with alcoholism or addiction to cocaine or heroin or meth, which is so prevalent in our community, it was such an opportunity to have, and Tatum even kept saying, you know, it's a disease and all of this, but it was really an opportunity to have a really frank conversation. And I think finally Tatum said, you know, when Oprah said, well, why did you want to come on and talk about this? Because at one point, Tatum didn't really give her much of an answer. And this is what I mean. I felt like Oprah was a little like threw the gauntlet down of like, well, why did you want to come on the show? And Tatum said, because I wanted people to know that even in sobriety, you can relapse or almost relapse. Like, I want people to know that this is not fixed, that this doesn't go away. Not that I'm going to tell you how to have it not happen to you. I don't know how it happened to me. You know,
I think that's brilliant. I think that's probably one of the most honest answers I've ever heard about addiction.
Yeah.
Is literally somebody just turning to you and going, "I don't know, I don't know."
But I do know what her next acting role is.
What?
I'm sitting there looking at her, and at the exact same moment, Kelly and I were both watching this, and we went, "She looks just like Madonna. She could be playing Madonna's life story now. They even kind of have the same affectation to their speech a little
bit." Isn't she a little long in the tooth to play her?
No, I mean, I just think she could play her from like 30 to 50.
Yeah, oh, when she's
play her.
I think
she could play her. They look very much alike. You know, Madonna's regimen is intense yoga and sinewy, almost chicken-like muscles and,
chicken-like.
You know what I mean? Like, her arms now look a little, I don't know. She looks like fowl.
Chickeny.
She looks like fowl.
She's foul. She's very fowly.
Yeah.
She's fowly.
And she's got that very skeletal face now. And
fowl-like.
You know, and of course, lovely Tatum O'Neill got it from the heroin chic real way. And Madonna got it from lots of money, lots of trainers, lots of yoga. And
Botox.
And Botox. There's two paths. Once again, the two paths. It could have been talk show host or hooker. I mean, if we'd just known the two paths, we could have picked.
Yeah, you're right.
You know, Tatum could have gone the guru workout trainer other path.
But she didn't.
But she
did
didn't.
Not.
Oh, well.
She chose not.
She did. Hey, let's tell you what Richard Knight Jr. thinks of the new film Burn After Reading. Plus, we've got some news and entertainment. And what's going on in the theater world in Chicago? It's picking up. It is picking up this September. And Levi Kreis on the show today. He's going to be a part of the theater scene here very soon on the Chicago stage in Million Dollar Quartet. Then you'll be back after this. Now
the movie thrilled millions. The legendary soundtrack won a place in our hearts forever. And now the unforgettable story of Baby and Johnny comes alive in a must-see theatrical phenomenon. And I owe it all to you. This is Dirty Dancing, the classic story on stage, and it's coming to Chicago. Exploding with heart-pounding music, sensational dancing, and breathtaking emotion. This worldwide stage hit will have its U.S. premiere at the Cadillac Palace Theater.
Watch me now.
Dirty Dancing begins performances September 28th. Get tickets now at BroadwayInChicago.com and have the time of your life at Dirty Dancing.
Culture Club. Culture Club. Culture Club. Theater.
Music.
Dance.
Art.
Performance.
Provocative.
Hilarious.
Exciting.
Queer.
Innovative.
Campy.
Edgy.
Original.
Get some culture in your life.
Join the club.
For the week of September 15th, 2008, you are in Chicago's Culture Club.
At Northlight Theater this Halloween season, one man's nightmares come to life in the classic psychological thriller, Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. This fiendishly clever new adaptation will thrill audiences with the startling truth that there's a little Hyde in all of us. Playing through October 26th, for information of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, visit northlight.org.
Forbidden Broadway, New York's acclaimed musical, returns to Chicago with a brand new show for 2008, gleefully ripping through Broadway's biggest hits and flops, including August, Osage County, Gypsy with Patti LuPone, and Young Frankenstein. Opens October 2nd at the Royal George Theater. Call 312-988-9000 or visit Ticketmaster.com for tickets.
Playing now, Court Theater in Hyde Park is proud to present the Chicago premiere of Tony Kushner's Caroline or Change, starring Ife Butler. The Boston Globe calls this award-winning musical a masterpiece. For tickets and information for Caroline or Change, visit courttheater.org.
The most successful rock and roll musical of all time, Buddy, the Buddy Holly story, is now playing at the Drury Lane Water Tower, featuring classics like La Bamba, That'll Be the Day, Chantilly Lace, and Peggy Sue. For ticket information, call the box office at 312-642-2000 or visit Ticketmaster.com.
Don't miss Turn of the Century, this season's star-studded musical by the writers of Jersey Boys and directed by Tommy Tune at the Goodman Theater. Jeff Daniels and Rachel York star in this romantic romp through time and the American Songbook. Tickets are on sale now at goodmantheater.org.
For more Culture Club, visit WindyCityTimes.com.
The ultimate feel-good musical is back and better than ever. Don't miss your chance to have the time of your life at Mamma Mia.
You can dance, you can jive, having the time of your life. Ooh, see that girl, watch that scene, living the dancing queen.
Let's go to the movies anyway.
I'm Richard Knight Jr. with another Night at the Movies Minute. The Coen brothers, who inexplicably held sway over most critics and susceptible moviegoers last year with what I think is one of the most highly overrated movies in recent memory, No Country for Old Men, have returned with Burn After Reading. Now this, my friends, is more like it. Here we are back on firm Coen brothers' bitter black comedic territory, a la Fargo and The Big Lebowski, and my favorite, Raising Arizona. And the laughs are plenty in this aptly tagged smart movie about stupid people. The movie's an espionage comedy in which all the characters are concerned with an elusive object, think What's Up Doc, with a lot more bite. In this case, the object is a disc containing what idiotic gym trainers Francis McDormand and Brad Pitt are convinced is packed with top secret government info. Both decide that the disc is worth big bucks and the duo set about blackmailing John Malkovich, the rightful owner of the disc. Pitt, who sports a pompadour similar to the one he wore in the little scene Johnny Suede, but you should track that down, it's a good movie. Crazy funny. He fancies himself a private detective, and he's the funniest thing in the movie, in a dream cast that includes George Clooney, Tilda Swinton, and Richard Jenkins. Everybody who relishes their role does very well with their parts. The laughs are consistent throughout, but unfortunately, as the movie goes along, so is the Coen's propensity for violence. When one of the major characters is killed off, it immediately lowers the comic wattage to a much lower level. Shame, shame on them for that. Burn After Reading, with its acrid flair and smartly written script that parades its merciless view of its characters, not unlike Thank You for Smoking, isn't going to be for all tastes, but the movie provides enough moments of snide humor and outsized laughs, that's big laughs, big, big laughs, to satisfy those who like their comedies dark, 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 did I mention dark, black. I'm Richard Knight Jr., and that's your Night at the Movies Minute.
It's going to be one of those nights with Kathy Griffin.
This is the hot ticket, am I right? This is it.
The outrageous Kathy Griffin, live.
You know, my mom thinks that I'm going to lose everything and then we're both going to have to live in her car and eat dog food.
Kathy Griffin.
She's sitting there with her Target bag. And when I say Target bag, I don't mean a purse that she purchased at Target.
October 14th through the 16th, and now a fourth and final show, Sunday, October 12th at the Chicago Theater.
I got a billionaire who doesn't care about money. Oh, yeah, you know what he does with his money? He, what's the expression? Helps people. I know.
Everyone's favorite D-list star, Kathy Griffin.
All new. That's right.
October 14th through the 16th, and now a fourth and final show, Sunday, October 12th at the Chicago Theater. Tickets for the October 14th show are still available. Tickets for October 12th show are on sale Friday morning at 10 at the box office, Ticketmaster, or online at LiveNation.com. Produced by Live Nation and Madison Square Garden Entertainment.
I'm Kirk Williamson.
I'm Amy Matheny.
And this is the Week in News. Senator Larry Craig, who was arrested last year in a Minneapolis airport for allegedly trying to solicit sex with an undercover cop in a sex sting operation, is back in court. The Republican senator is trying to toss out the guilty plea he issued last year after his arrest. Craig's attorneys say that they want the guilty plea reversed because there wasn't enough evidence to prove his guilt.
Openly gay former New Jersey Governor Jim McGreevy's ex-wife dropped her fraud claims against him. McGreevy publicly came out of the closet 4 years ago. Dina Matos, his ex, claimed that McGreevy allegedly tricked her into marrying him. The former couple's divorce and child custody battle ended in August. Matos said she dropped the fraud claim for the benefit of their daughter.
California's Episcopal bishops recently urged voters to vote no on Proposition 8 in November. Proposition 8 would amend the California Constitution to ban gay marriage. Same-sex marriage is currently legal in California following a groundbreaking decision by the state Supreme Court. California's six Episcopal bishops came out in opposition to Proposition 8, saying marriage provides these couples the same legal rights and protections that heterosexual couples take for granted.
Russian prosecutors recently labeled a gay episode of South Park as extremist and warned a Russian TV station that aired the episode. The prosecutor's office would not specify which exact episode they were referring to in court, but their investigation followed complaints from a Russian evangelical group that said South Park cartoons should be banned because they promote homosexuality and pedophilia as norms of sexual life.
Victoria Posh Beckham and Gordon Ramsay of Hell's Kitchen announced at GQ's Men of the Year Awards that they are opening a restaurant together. The restaurant will be located in Los Angeles and will feature a traditional English-style menu.
The keeper of the American Songbook, singer Michael Feinstein, and his companion of 11 years, Terrence Flannery, are planning to be married on October 17th in Los Angeles with their friend, Judith Schindlin, better known as Judge Judy, officiating. She will be assisted by Gabrielle Ferrer, an Episcopal priest, and who is the son of Rosemary Clooney. Ms. Clooney, who was a mother figure to Mr. Feinstein and many other musicians, was the biggest influence on his style.
Director Steven Soderbergh is working on a biopic about the flamboyant piano player and entertainer Liberace. Liberace never admitted he was gay during his life, though he died in the late 80s from an AIDS-related illness. Soderbergh has cast actor Michael Douglas to play Liberace. He also wants to cast Matt Damon to play the part of Scott Dorson, the man who claimed he was Liberace's partner and who sued him in 1982 for millions in palimony. And that's the weekend news brought to you by Windy City Times.
Hey, pigs! This is Judy Tenuta, the mom goddess, and you're listening to Queercast. It makes my hormones slam dance. It could happen.
See them nerves hanging around with my brain. Too much of love, drive a man insane. You broke my will, what a thrill. Good desperation, so play ball my vibe.
Levi Levi Kreiss is an openly gay recording artist and actor whose career began very early in Tennessee and then continued as he toured in the musical Rent and as he went on to appear in many films. His most recent CD, The Gospel According to Levi, both showcased both a strong voice for the GLBT community and someone with fierce passion and compassion for his community. And he just completed a 251-city tour. Good heavens. Now he is slipping into the infamous role of Jerry Lee Lewis in Million Dollar Quartet that is playing at the Goodman Owen Theater. Hey, Levi, how are you?
Hey, Amy, it's great to be back. How are you?
Oh, it's good to talk to another Tennessean. I always love that.
It's just like having comfort food, isn't it?
It's like having my collards and my chicken and dumplings. That's what it is.
There you go. There you go. That's a good country girl.
So 251 city tour. It makes me say, goodness gracious, great balls of fire. I can't resist.
Great balls of fire. That would be a pretty appropriate thing to say. Well, by now it's over 300. So that 251 was in a period of like 16 months. And now... I've added a few more months. I kind of came to Chicago with a little over 300 dates under my belt.
Wow.
That's 2.5, 3 years, maybe pushing 3 years.
It's just intense because I know when we talked to you about a year ago and we were talking about The Gospel According to Levi, you were in the midst of this tour. And what do you love about touring? Because you really have to... You have to dig it to be on the road that much.
Yeah.
It's
sort of one of those things where this just happens to be the trade that I'm comparable at. So you clock in and you go to work, you know? I do love it because, it allows me to be one-on-one with those people out there across the country who have been real supportive of my musical endeavors, I mean, they're the reasons why I'm able to make a living off of it, and I want to see these people one-on-one,
Yeah. So when you're touring, do you love going to the big cities as much as the small towns? And did you find a little gem of a place that you're like, wow, I should come back here and hang out? I would have never thought of coming here.
Well, I love the southern cities because they just, I know it's probably a blanket statement to make, but southerners get other southerners, and I have so much fun in cities like Louisville, Kentucky, and Nashville, and all the way sweeping down through Mississippi and Georgia and Mississippi, Atlanta, I have a great time at, all through Texas. God bless them right now. But I have so much fun in the South. And but it's been fun to get to know audiences in New York. They're a very different kind of listening audience. So is the case in the Northwest, too. They're a little more reserved, maybe a little more intellectual with how they kind of experience their live music. All in all, though, everyone seems very generous at the end of the day and supportive, and that's what keeps me going.
Now, have there been any just truly horrible experiences on the road? We want to hear about the dirty nitty gritty of being like a famous singer songwriter. Like, there've got to be parts and times when you're like, oh, this will go into my movie. When they write the movie of my life.
I will be candid enough to at least share that I do understand now, being on the road to this length, why artists can become divas. And it's not that they're really divas, it's that so many people along the way are not going to, try to get away with not having the equipment that they signed off in the contract to have, or not have this. Artists are notoriously taken advantage of, and it seems as though the longer you're on the road, the more you begin to learn, wait a minute, I hate to play this role, but I might have to be a little bit of an a-hole to make sure everything is there and in place and ready for those people who paid money to come and see me.
Yeah.
So I actually have gained a little insight into, because I used to kind of snub my nose at, you know, and like tout this whole, well, I'm down to earth and accessible, and I'm from Tennessee, and I don't understand why artists can be mean like that. Well, I get it now, because It actually is almost like you have to adopt that in so many sort of situations going from city to city to city to just make sure things are, like, met up in place, and those people that are supporting you and paying their money to see you get what they came for.
Now, do you find a difference when you play a venue where, you know, you play a gay venue, or when you just play a regular old, you know, joint that just wants to hear a good singer, songwriter, music?
Well, I'm always going to be fond of the Pride Festivals, because there's always, you know, all summer long, Pride Festival after Pride Festival. It's nothing but celebrating who we are and celebrating the free, you know, the progress that we've made in our community. That's great. As far as, like, gay clubs versus regular clubs, people are just people, you know. Yeah. It seems like they just blend one into the other. I have every bit as many females, if not more, that come to see my shows as I do gay men. Mm. So it sort of just kind of evens itself out.
Talk to me a little bit. I mean, I know we talked about this last time you were on, but, you know, when did you come out, and what was that experience like for you growing up in the South?
Well, coming out professionally was, a story told with my debut album, One of the Ones, because I had spent many years in the closet, in the entertainment closet, working with different labels and trying to be their idea of what they think would have sold. Initially, though, coming out personally was a little bit of a nightmare. Mm. I didn't really sort of make the choice. Circumstances exposed me for what my inner struggles were. I was in my first, I had gone through 6 years of reparative therapy starting in junior high school behind my parents' back. They didn't know I was checking myself in and trying to understand this and heal myself and become, you know, quote, in my mind, what I considered healthy. Eventually, I began to reinterpret my idea of God. We all know that from the Gospel According to Levi. The whole album was written about that process.
Yeah.
But at the end of the day, I said, okay, well, I'm going to open myself up to this, have a relationship with a man, and choose to love. And it turned out that this guy happened to be an alcoholic, and he was abusive, and it was kind of nasty. And actually, it was my mom who noticed what was going, who put two and two together, what was going on with me and my, quote, roommate, that she confronted me and said, oh, okay, I know what's going on with you, and we're getting out of this situation. Mm. And so all of a sudden, all these years of this, like, sincere little boy spending 3 hours a day in his room praying and reading the Bible, and my parents seeing this behavior and thinking, wow, this is a devout little guy, but now realizing what the struggle was all about, in that moment, you know, my mom came to my rescue in that situation. Yeah. But I think also it proved to her that this, in her mind, her idea that this lifestyle was unhealthy, not of God, destructive, because that's what she was seeing from the experience that she saw from me. So we've gone past that now. We're in a really great place, me and my mom. But that's sort of how I came out to my family. And from there, you know, it became an issue at school because I was very active in the Christian organizations. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of my roommates found out that I had been studying this issue, and I decided to really question whether or not the Bible, you know, condemned this behavior or not. And he went and told the Baptist Student Union of the college, and they went and told the board of directors, and the board of directors went and met over whether or not to keep me active in the school. And at the end of the day, I was packing my bags.
Yeah.
So there was how I came out to my friends.
Yeah.
So, and then, like, being on the verge of this Christian record coming out at the time that all this is happening, and an intern at the label is going to the college, and they find out, and I lose that whole deal. That whole conversation of having that album out, that was gone. No more Christian music for me. So it was sort of, I was sort of pried out of the closet.
Yeah, I was about to say, you have one of those stories that it's like you kind of feel the ripping sensation of, you know, pulling those doors back and kind of shoving you out. You know, you were exposed along the way, like every aspect. And yet, interestingly enough, you know, and based on, you know, my spirituality, I would think it's interesting that if you were praying for God, you know, to either show you or reveal to you or, you know, help you with the situation, that maybe it was just that kind of shoving you out and proclaiming authenticity, you know, with all the pain that was going to come with it, you know?
I aim in that because I certainly have no regrets to the way that it happened, because I think that as committed as I was to the idea of maybe, you know, changing who I was, the idea of really fitting in as much as I could to that whole, like, fundamental Christian box, I sort of needed to be kicked out, because I think I probably would have spent another few years, you know, trying to fit in.
Yeah.
Trying to make it work somehow, to some degree.
And we know that all that reparative therapy doesn't work. I mean, that's, you know, coming to the light and once again to the forefront with Sarah Palin's church, which, you know, is known for doing a lot of reparative or ex-gay ministry work. And that story is one that needs to continue to come out, that there's so much harm caused by that. I am curious, when you started studying from a theological standpoint and biblically, how you could, you know, view homosexuality in the eyes of the Old or New Testament. Did you go to any books? Were there any things that you found a lot that just really opened your eyes up to answering that theological debate for yourself?
Well, let me first say that as far as the scripture is concerned, and as far as my Christian upbringing is concerned, I certainly don't want to speak in any other tone but respectful, because I, in some way, it's still a part of who I am, even though I have expanded my view of God to include many other different ideas that might be borrowed from many other different religions. And I also am quite the proponent that that there are many ways that for someone to say that this is the only way to heaven, and if you don't believe exactly the way I am, you're wrong. That kind of separatist consciousness and exclusive mentality is what separates us across and causes the wars and the destruction and the hurt and the pain and all these precious kids that I see on the road that have been struggling with this religion versus sexuality. And and I can just see how they beat up on themselves for all their whole, you know, young life. I've talked myself around to the point where I remember what your question was, Amy.
No. Well, I just have a very similar background to you, you know. I mean, I was raised, know, in the South and in a Christian upbringing, and would still define myself kind of at the base, at the core of my foundation is a Christian theology. But I too feel like my God got bigger, you know. My God got bigger and kinder and gentler and more diverse. And more expansive. But I just know for myself, like, I read a book called The Good Book by Peter Gomes. I was reading, you know, just other people to try to make sense of it for myself, and also for my family that I knew would be struggling with it, and that they would struggle with it from a biblical sense, you know. I just didn't know it, being in a Christian school. I'm assuming you had a lot of texts, so you indicated that you had kind of studied for yourself, and I just didn't know if there were other good references.
Oh, absolutely. Well, you know, I took the Strong's Concordance, which is a concordance of all the words of the King James Version of the Bible, the Hebrew and the Greek, and I compiled all the verses directly or indirectly related to the issue, and I sat and I looked at every original meaning of it, and at the end of the day, when I approached the Bible with absolute objectivity, and I can truly, honestly, purely say that I did approach this from an objective point of view, because all I wanted to know was the truth. And if that meant that it was very clear that God says this is wrong, okay, I want to just embrace that and be obedient. Yep. But I just kept finding that the argument just sort of was loose.
Yeah.
And while there are very clear statements that people can take out of context and use against us, when you really become a student of the Bible and its culture, the culture and the history of it, and the, you begin to sort of understand, okay, wait a minute, this is not really all that threatening to me.
Yeah, no, I'm with you.
You know, so it allowed me to start thinking outside the box and be able to interpret this historical book in a pure way and think for myself rather than just regurgitating what I had heard time and time and time and time and time again growing up. And I think that's hard for a lot of people. I don't know that it that I would like to think that the majority want to do a complete overhaul of their belief system and be able to do that and say, you know what, I'm throwing everything out that has kind of been predetermined that I should believe, and I'm going to start from scratch, and I'm going to decide what I want to believe from the bottom up. I admire anyone who takes on that.
Well, and that's the spiritual journey, right? I mean, to me, that is the spiritual journey, you know, that we're asked to be on no matter what faith we're in. You know, we're never asked to just learn to memorize stuff. We're asked to be on a spiritual journey, I believe. So talking about the journey, I mean, I'm sure there is much of your Tennessee roots that you are able to bring to this character of Jerry Lee Lewis. And yet some of it that just seems like so outlandish, and I can only imagine, you know, he was not sitting, well, maybe he wasn't sitting on his knees a-praying to be changed. I mean, he was the great radical, you know, kind of rock and roll in many, many ways. Tell me first, what is the story of Million Dollar Quartet, just to give everybody an overview of what the show is about?
The Million Dollar Quartet is what they referred to as that one serendipitous night in December 4th, 1956, where fate brought Johnny Cash, Jerry Lee Lewis, Carl Perkins, and Elvis Presley back to Sun Records in Memphis, Tennessee. Sam Phillips, who had discovered these guys who owned the studio, they had all come to see him and all ended up jamming together. And actually, Sam Phillips ran a recording of it. There's this one recording called The Million Dollar Quartet, which is a very rare recording of the four of them sitting together as friends, singing old hymns, some of Elvis's songs, just, you know, a few songs here and there. It was a very kind of rare moment. What this particular musical tries to do here at our national launch here at the Goodman Theater in Chicago is give you an intimate look into the personal relationships that these four men have. You know, they did they were friends. They, you know, there were dynamics that we're not aware of. And at the end of the day, it's a real interesting snapshot that you see kind of the beginning of the end of rockabilly music. You get all this rich rockabilly history and how they all came to this point on December 4th, 1956. But when you see where they're all headed, with Johnny Cash going more the gospel and country and the train songs and you know, Elvis going to the movies and Carl Perkins slowly fading, you know, out of the picture, you're thinking, well, you know, maybe Jerry Lee's the last great hope of keeping that, you know, rockabilly going, and you know, his own personal circumstances took him where they did. But it's a real interesting kind of moment in time that they have created a nice little scenario around, and above all, it's just a rocking good time. I mean, we've got, you know, these guys, these are players, you know, the actors, we the actors are the band, and playing this whole show is nothing but fun. It's a rock and roll good time. It's awesome.
So you're playing piano in the show?
Yeah, this is Jerry Lee Lewis is the role that I'm playing, and I was hired that night as a session player for what was to be Carl Perkins' recording session. And then Elvis was going to swing by, you know, and talk to Sam Phillips about something. And then Johnny Cash swung by. It ended up sort of kind of just unfolding and being something no one would have ever expected.
So what has it been for you to try to transform into this kind of outrageous onstage persona? I mean, you know, just to get that performance quality, you know. Had to get a perm to your hair, I guess.
You know, it's actually not so much of a stretch, because some of the first music I ever heard was one of the first 45s I ever heard was Great Balls of Fire, my mom playing it. By the time I was 12 years old, you know, every time we'd have a family reunion, you know, I'd get up there, this little guy, and I would full on go out with, you know, great balls of fire. I was playing Jerry Lee Lewis stuff at an early age. Mm. So I grew up very familiar with his music. And actually, there's a commonality between Jerry Lee and myself in that there is an internal conflict. And a lot of these guys back then had this internal conflict. The whole theory of rock and roll at the time was that it was very worldly, that it promoted dancing and premarital sex and rebellion. And, you know, it was different times back then. And they all had an internal struggle with growing up good Christian boys.
Right.
And
Southern good Christian boys.
Good Southern Christian boys. And then being a vehicle for something as devilish as rock and roll music. And, you know, Jerry Lee Lewis's cousin was Jimmy Swaggart, who I grew up watching on
Me
TV
too.
And listening to him preach,
oh,
right?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, you too. Oh, you remember him?
Oh, I do. I remember, like, Jimmy Swaggart and Ernest Ainsley and... Oh God! Well, I remember Jim Baker, but he seemed much later to me, in strangely enough. But yeah, I remember Swaggart a lot.
Yeah, yeah. So I kind of tapped into that struggle, that internal struggle that Jerry Lee had, and actually, it is highlighted for a moment in play. You kind of begin to see that these boys really are sincere about how they believe, and maybe they are always second guessing themselves about this whole rock and roll thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
Mm-hmm. What are some of the songs that are featured in the show? Because I know most of them will be, recognizable to audiences. Because, I mean, I think that, this is the music of the dawn of rock and roll.
Right. Well, you know, we got Great Balls of Fire. We got a whole lot of shaking going on.
Yeah.
We got... Real Wild Child, I Hear You Knocking, See You Later, Alligator, 16 Tons, That's All Right, Mama, you know, I've got some of Elvis's staples in there. And it turns out that a lot of the music that we're showcasing in this musical, we took some, the creators took a few creative liberties because some of the songs that we're playing were not actually sang that night.
Yeah.
But, you know, some old gospel hymns like Down by the Riverside, that was performed that evening, and we definitely make that kind of a staple of our show.
Yeah. It's so amazing, you know, these four talents all coming on stage. And, you know, there's some sort of phenomenon going on, I guess, with musical theater. For a while there, we thought with Wicked, you know, it was going to be all about young girls coming to theater and teenage girls. And now with Jersey Boys, and it sounds like with your show, there's this nostalgia of these men, you know, these great male recording artists that people are so evocative of moments in their life. And even you have evocative moments of singing Great Balls of Fire, you know, as a young kid. Are there things that people would be surprised to know about Jerry Lee Lewis that in doing your research that you discovered? I mean, many people, of course, know that he married his cousin, correct? Is his cousin? Was a young?
Yeah. You know, I've always, for after looking at Jerry Lee, I actually think that he's just that kind of guy that you don't really have to, like, I haven't discovered, and I could have totally missed this, but I haven't discovered a mystery about Jerry Lee Lewis. You know, I mean, he's pretty much appears in my, from what I have studied and what I've worked with, from what I know, he's so out on the table about everything. That you don't have to really guess. What I find interesting is maybe, you know, people didn't know that Carl Perkins wrote Blue Suede Shoes, and that was supposed to be his big hit, and then he was on his way to perform it at the Perry Como show when Elvis Presley performs it on the Ed Sullivan show, and then all of a sudden everybody is saying wouldn't play Carl Perkins' version of Blue Suede Shoes because they thought he was covering Elvis. And there's this whole animosity that you begin to, this whole interrelationship that you probably wouldn't know about unless you see this, you know, this musical. So there's good stuff like that that are nice surprises to find out. Jerry Lee's serves as some necessary comic relief a lot of the time.
Well, it sounds like an amazing show. Now, it originally was produced in Seattle. Is that correct?
Yeah, and, you know, Amy, I've actually been working with this piece I think ever since 2001, when they began to conceptualize this idea way back in Los Angeles, I was the guy they came to for Jerry Lee. And so I have seen this script go through so many changes you can't even imagine. So I feel like, personally, there's a payoff, you know, in a way that it's kind of like an accomplishment of like, okay, great. I've gone in so many times to help workshop this. And you know, I was on the road touring my own albums when they opened and did a trial run in Daytona, Florida, which preceded Seattle, which was last year, which was my rejoining of the piece. And we broke, you know, all these box office records in Seattle, and the reviews were fantastic. And I just have a feeling we're going to, you know, hopefully have the same thing here in Chicago.
Well, people should definitely not miss it because it is a limited run. So this is not one of those shows that's going to be here forever. So you need to get your tickets now. It's Million Dollar Quartet. It's playing September 27th through October 26th. So still time to get those tickets for those first performances. It's at the Goodman's Owen Theater, which is one of my favorite spaces in the city of Chicago. The Owen Theater is within the Goodman Building at 170 North Dearborn. And if you'd like tickets and information, you can visit MillionDollarQuartetLive.com. And if you want more on Levi and want to pick up one of his CDs or just see where he's touring, because the man is a touring machine. He'll be here for a little while, but visit levichrist.com, and that will also be linked in our show notes. Are you writing any right now, or is your focus entirely on getting this show open?
Oh, do you think I actually wouldn't have something going on?
No, I think that you're writing. I'm wondering when the next CD's coming.
January.
Well, then we'll be talking to you again in the new year and getting that one out on our airwaves. Yes, Levi, Break Legs.
I'm more excited about this one than any of them so far. So.
Oh, you're kidding. And why is that?
Oh, no, it's clear. Because I think it's gone back to my roots. You know, we've talked a lot about that, the gospel mm-hmm. roots, the southern roots. It feels more quintessentially Levi than anything I've recorded, and it took a long time to get there.
So. Wow. Well, I can't wait to hear it. Do you have a title for it yet?
Yes, it's called Where I Belong.
There you go. It's amazing the journey it takes to figure that out, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And yours has been epic, so it'll be very exciting to see you release that here in January. Well, we'll have you back on the show, so let us know. Send us a copy of it.
Anytime, and thank you, Amy. It's been a pleasure talking with you.
And don't miss Levi Christ and all the guys in Million Dollar Quartet. All the information's on our show. We'll be back.
Bud Light presents Real Men of Genius.
Real Men of Genius.
Today we salute you, Mr. Taxicab Over-Accessorizer.
Mr. Taxicab Over-Accessorizer.
Bobbleheads, tropical air freshener, an antique chandelier. You've got it all covered in tinsel and Mardi Gras beads.
I can't see the road.
When it comes to interior design, you don't trust anything that can't be plugged into a cigarette lighter.
Can I use your toaster?
No matter where they're going, your passengers always ask the same question. Is this a taxi cab or a Turkish bazaar?
How much for the candelabra?
So take a day off and crack open an ice cold Bud Light night of the knick-knack. Because only you can proudly say, yes, I do have junk in my trunk.
Mr. Taxi Cab Over Accessorizer.
Bud Light Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
Alex, it's been so lovely to be on with you. This has been a show that has just, we've spanned topics on this show.
We spanned.
With great theatrical yes. works and stars of the 1940s and 50s and hookers and Tatum O'Neill.
It was good. It was all good. It went down well, like a great, big, beautiful diaphragm.
Ooh.
I don't know what I'm... Actually. The sounds of sex. That was good. That's like an echo set. Oh. Oh.
Ooh.
Oh.
Harder.
Dear.
There.
Something happened.
Mm. Yeah.
Well.
Ooh.
Mother? Oh, I didn't like that one. That scared me. That sounded like there was something crawling out of you.
That's normally
tiny.
What I do. I normally do the laugh. And you light a cigarette, which I hear you doing in the background.
I did. I just lit a cigarette. Don't say that over the radio. People will know that I'm smoking. And I didn't do that. Was it that big?
No, I just heard I heard you flick your bick.
I beg your pardon.
I heard you.
That check is clear.
Flick your bick.
Don't talk about my bick on the radio. On the radio. On the radio. That's not how that song goes at all.
It is too.
Is it?
Someone told the story of Romeo on the radio.
Well, that's it. You did it better than I did. I was doing, I don't know what I was doing. I was doing something else. Not that, though.
You missed your calling.
I did.
You should have been Hooker? Donna Summer.
Yeah. Queer talk show host.
Queer talk show host. It's lovely to have you back, my lady. I missed you very much. I hope that you'll come to Chicago soon, but keep up with Alex on her blog, on her live journal at alexanderbillings.com. And you can find out more about Million Dollar Quartet as well by looking on our show notes on our site. Check out our new and improved website and post a comment or let us know if there's something you'd like to see on the site that's not there, the WindyCityQueercast.com. In case you download us via iTunes, check out our site every now and again and you can post a comment or, you know, you can even call in and maybe we'll play your message on the air, on the shows. We would love that. Love to hear from
you. Do it.
Do it. All right. I'm going to sit here and fantasize about you smoking, yet another thing that I don't do anymore.
Oh, good for you.
I don't do anything anymore.
That's not true. You do a lot of things. You just don't smoke.
I just don't smoke.
That's right. That's fantastic.
It's an honorable thing.
It's a very good thing. And it's a very good thing.
I don't smoke and I don't have sex with you. Those are the things
true.
I don't do.
Well, we can rectify the sex if you want.
Oh.
Sure.
We'll talk about it on the next show.
Let's do it.
All right. Thanks for listening to another Windy City Queercast. This program is brought to you in part by Bud Light. Bud Light keeps it coming. Broadway in Chicago. For the hottest tickets in town, visit BroadwayInChicago.com. And American Airlines, offering exciting GLBT vacations online at aa.com/rainbow. Special thanks to our Queercast family, Kirk Williamson, newscaster, Amy Wooten, news editor, and Di Sturkey, production editor. I'm Amy Matheny, your host. Please comment on our shows at WindyCityQueercast.com and iTunes. The next Queercast is only days away, so don't miss it. Subscribe today. Windy City Queercast. Queer and now.